All right, I want to just begin with just a short scripture verse in Psalm 78. We have so much to cover, and I just didn't want to cover it without a little scripture at least. There are so many facts here. There are so many places. There are so many things that we're going to be talking about. But Psalm 78, I'm just going to read the verses 1 through 4. Give ear, O my people, to my law. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known, and our fathers have told us. We will not hide them from their children. And then this, showing to the generation to come the praises of the Lord and his strength and his wonderful works that he hath done. And what we're talking about today is wonderful works that God has done. As we look at the wonderful works he did through the faith and labors of one Samuel Worcester, a missionary to the Cherokee. Now, during this whole missionary biography, we will be talking about that particular missionary to the Cherokee people. And during the course of that, we're going to be talking about a genuine, grievous, inexcusable injustice done to the Cherokee people by the state of Georgia, President Andrew Jackson, and some in the federal government, not all, with regard to elected officials. Now, these days, of course, the whole history of relations between the American Indian people and the whites, if you will, the white settlers, if you will, of this country has been utterly perverted to the point of where the American government and military is said to have followed a policy of genocide against the Indians. And in fact, we read in many places that the American government and even the white race in general are said to be guilty of committing a holocaust against the Indians of America. Of course, this is reckless talk. It stirs up hatred and animosity. And it's simply, of course, not true. If our federal government, and along with the collusion, if you will, of all the white people of this country, and not just white people, Hispanics in the Southwest and so forth, but if they all came together to exterminate the Indians, they would have been exterminated, wouldn't they? At a certain point, because the government was so powerful, our military, if you look at by the end of the end of the 19th century at least, now also ignored and often perverted is the true history of the Indian tribes or nations, if you will. I say if you will, because I know that as they want to be called Native Americans, and that's fine too, Native Americans want to speak of nations, not tribes. But this has been perverted. We want to just briefly address that. Now, the first thing I want to mention is that when I keep saying the white people, I'm just trying to differentiate. We're not saying white people are better than red people or any such thing, and you know that. But it's often said that the Europeans came, and so they did. And we could say Europeans, but eventually also there were others that became part of our nation, weren't there? There were Hispanics or Mexicans that came into our nation. We just are using white people as opposed to the Indian race. Now, that doesn't make us racist, of course, but we'll stay with that to make things very simple. But this country, if you look at the lower 48 states of America, when the white people began to settle, when people came and began to settle. Certainly, as you go back, even to the time of Columbus, when people weren't settling yet, but the Indian population, by all figures I can come to, I've seen a low, and it's called the most credible low. So in other words, historians and anthropologists accept this as possibly true or possibly accurate. 900,000 is all Indians in this whole 48 states. As you look north of the Rio Grande, the highest I've seen, by far the highest, is 18 million. One figure that was come to in 1910 by anthropologist Jay Mooney, a figure that many experts think might be fairly accurate, is 1,200,000 Indians. Now, think of this whole country, because we often hear, well, they came in and pushed Indians off their land. Well, it's a pretty big land, isn't it? And I know that as you read the histories of this country, there were huge areas where no Indians actually lived. They just hunted. They were their hunting grounds. Kentucky, for instance, different tribes hunted there. We can't spend much time there. I just wanted to mention it. But simply put, it was not a settled country, if you will. Now, there were some Indian tribes, we want to hasten to add, we don't want to paint with too broad a brush, that did have specific areas where they farmed and so forth, and they stayed in those general areas. Others did not. Now, the next thing I just want to mention with regard to the history of the Indians of this country, before and after the arrival of the white man, is that by and large, they warred on each other. It was constant warfare with regard to a great many of them, constant warfare between Indian tribes and confederations. The record establishes that various Indian tribes often, in this warfare, killed not just the men and even the captive men, but the women and the children, the old and the young of other tribes. And those taken captive were very often put to horrific, drawn-out tortures, the details of which I'm not going to describe because there will be children, perhaps, that listen to this. Now, we're not, again, going to paint with a broad brush. Is this true of every single Indian tribe? Not necessarily. Some were worse than others. But it is generally true that this happened. And certainly there was, even with regard to some Indian tribes, such as, well, those that belong to the Iroquois Federation, perhaps not every one of them, but that confederation, where they involved themselves in a ritualistic cannibalism of their enemies. Now, another terrible reality is outrage against women captives was the norm for many tribes. It was the constant, including, of course, the exceedingly brutal Comanche. It was just commonplace. Women captives, if allowed to live, were then afterward condemned to a life of what amounted to being a concubine. Young children not killed were generally adopted and raised as Indian children. The law of the jungle was the rule of Indian warfare. Many tribes also, with regard to their aged or with regard to handicapped children born handicapped, they just exposed them to the elements, left them to die. And so this is the reality. And some tribes were more extreme than others. Are we surprised? No, it's not just Indians. Romans chapter 1, verses 18 through 32. We won't go there. We've taught on that many times. But this is man without the word of God. This is man without the savoring influence of the gospel and the word preached and a church in the midst. This is where man ends up. It's where we would end it up. And so we need to mention these things. Now, all these brutal practices continued after the Europeans, we'll use the word then because that was the beginning of settlement, they were Europeans, after they first landed on the shores of this country. Now, they continued. And then right through the colonial period, and with some tribes right on through the 19th century until the end of the Indian Wars. Now, we don't say every tribe was as ruthless. We keep stressing that. But certainly, this was a more of a general rule that there was a certain cruelty, barbarity, if you will, with regard to how they treated their captives, including then white captives. And so you see how this could all make for this hatred, too, that some had the one for the other, Indians against whites, whites against Indians. Now, we hear about, can I pronounce their name right? I doubt it. The Wampanoag Indians, that it was a confederation that helped the pilgrims survive in this new land, and where would they be without them? Well, they would have been in trouble. So we thank God that he sent them. But what's often not known is that Squanto and Samoset and the others that helped rendered that help after the chief of the Wampanoag made a treaty with the Pilgrims, which was included at least a pledge of mutual defense against the Narragansett tribe, very powerful tribe that the Wampanoags feared would exterminate them. And that treaty held. And they actually defended each other against the Narragansetts. So it was a mutual defense. That's forgotten, isn't it? It's like out of the goodness of the heart, this tribe just did this. Now, virtually every tribe or nation or Indian confederation had its hated hereditary enemies. And so warfare was an ongoing way of life for most of them. We take the Ojibwe here in Wisconsin and the Dakota Sioux that used to be here in Wisconsin until pushed out into Minnesota by the Ojibwe. They hated, they killed, they tortured each other generation after generation. A favorite tactic of each was to creep into the other's territory with a war party. Not that they didn't have full-fledged fights between the braves at times too, but this was more often the case. Creep into the other's territory, watch a village. When the warriors went off to hunt, fish, gather food, attack the village, brutally slaughter the old people, the women, the children, and then retreat back into their own territory. And so it was back and forth. It was retaliatory attacks, and it went on and on. And you have the tribes of the Northeast around the eastern Great Lakes, which lived in mortal fear of the Iroquois Nation, who pushed some of them out as well, took their land. Out west, the Crows and the Blackfeet hated each other. The Bannocks feared both. The Comanche and the Tonkawa of the Southwest, they hated one another. The Comanches were the more powerful, but the Tonkawa eventually even guided the U.S. Army against the Comanche, and that's why. This was an enemy they hated and feared. The Apache feared the Comanche. They hated each other, and it just went on and on and on. The Utes and the Comanche fought each other, hated each other, tribes against tribes, and so this has all been forgotten. And along with the reality that the stronger Indian tribes often dispossess the weaker of their home ground. We hear how the Europeans push the Indians out of their territory. We do not deny what happened as these Indian wars went on, these conflicts. We do not say that the if you want to call them Europeans, but the white settlers always acted with justice toward the Indians because they didn't. But the Indians were doing this as well, and see, that's forgotten. The weaker were pushed out. If they didn't go, they'd just be massacred or turned into slaves because there was slavery among the Indians, of course. And we could give you an example, though, of dispossession of land. One tribe losing its land to a stronger tribe, the Iroquois, drove the Sauk out of the eastern part of our country, and they came here, and they, of course, settled in southern Wisconsin and through Illinois. And then, of course, we mentioned the Dakota Sioux as well. And then we've already mentioned, too, the slavery as well. I think in a past presentation, we talked about the French and Indian Wars and how the Indians, led by the French, urged on often by Romish priests, would make raids on the colonial villages, and very bloody raids, and massacre as many men, women, and children as they happen to massacre and take others captive. And then they would, with regard to the children, and sometimes the women, they would keep them or trade them when they go back into, certainly as far as French Canada often. And sometimes in the case of the children, sell them to French families that didn't have children. So we raised the question, were there no injustices, though, committed against the Indians by the U.S. government and military? Yes, there were. Were there not massacres of Indian people by armed whites, small groups, large groups, at times military men? Yes, it was not the policy of the U.S. government, but there were massacres. Sometimes there would be a group of settlers, for instance, that come across a family, fellow settlers, if you will, to call them that, been massacred in terrible ways by the Indians. Well, when they caught up with the Indians, what would happen? So it was retaliatory. We know that's not right. But I mean that, yes, they would commit acts of brutality themselves. As far as massacres, we could mention the infamous Sand Creek Massacre. I mean, this was a village of friendly Indians. I mean, friendly in the sense they had made peace. There were a lot of old people and women there, and they were massacred, but not by the U.S. Army, by a Colorado militia led by an officer who ended up enduring court-martial. He should have been punished for mass murder. He wasn't. But many of the military high-ranking officers were just outraged, and they did put him through a court-martial. And so there was no excuse for it. And then there were, we could think of the massacre at Wounded Knee, December 1890. Well, eyewitness accounts of that give a little bit different story than what you hear. The Indians in question were, of course, surrounded by the 7th Cavalry. They had agreed to lay down their weapons, and they were going to go to a reservation. When the day came to confiscate those weapons, there was a medicine man doing his ghost dance and urging the men to fight, the warriors. And they hadn't turned in the weapons when they said they would. They had them in teepees, hid, and they had them under blankets, the braves did, many of them, that they wore. The medicine man kept urging them on. An Indian named Black Coyote, if I remember right, he had a struggle with the soldier. When the soldier tried to confiscate the weapon, he fired his weapon. Warfare broke out. And in the crossfire, women and children died. Yes, they were right in the mix there. And of course, there are reports that some women actually pulled knives and took part in it. But many were killed in the crossfire, and then some did flee, and they were brutally shot down by some soldiers. It wasn't planned, not all, and they should have been severely punished. And there was much criticism and outcry against that, what happened, and the result was 150 dead Lakota warriors, old men, women, and children. But of course, no excuse for that. There were also 25 dead soldiers and 39 wounded. So it wasn't just a one-way thing entirely. And so you have this. You have this. And we don't want to go on and on, but we want to say a few more things, a few more things on this, because we could just go through a long list of massacres by Indians also of whites. And from colonial times on, I will just mention a couple of, certainly one larger one here, two, I believe. Have you heard of Fort Mims, Alabama? The date was August 30th, 1813. It was during the Creek Wars, and Creek warriors called Red Sticks, they were able to enter Fort Mims in Alabama through a gate carelessly left open, and in the end, they just brutally slaughtered a very minimum of 250 men, women, and children that were living there. Lots of women and children as well. And the number, many say, is quite higher. I've heard 300, close to 400, but we'll go with the 250. And there's many, many massacres where it's 50, 25, several hundred over a number of days, maybe hundreds even, in some cases, in different parts of the country. You all know about the Dakota Sioux uprising in Minnesota in 1862 when there were so few federal troops present because of the Civil War. The Sioux rampaged through that area of Minnesota. They killed, from what I've seen, it's probably a minimum of 800 men, women, and children. Some say 1,000, some say 500. But it was a great number, and again, they committed outrage against some of the women they captured. And then there's all those many, many documented examples from all over the country of Indian warriors brutally doing to death settlers' family. I'm just going to give you one example. On May 10th, Sunday morning, 1782, Pastor John Corbley and his family left their cabin in southwest Pennsylvania, where they lived, in order to walk a short distance to where Pastor Corbley was going to hold a church service and preach. This is May 10th, 1782. He had asked his wife, Betsy to bring his Bible. And he was walking well behind, contemplating his sermon. And she realized she didn't have the Bible. So he went back for it. Indians had been watching. He left. They attacked. When he came back, it was in progress. It was over quickly. But with extreme brutality, with knives and tomahawks, they killed Betsy, infant Nancy, Mary Catherine, age 2, Isaiah, age 6, Elizabeth, age 7, Delilah, aged 8, and John, age 14, managed to escape. And so there, we can point to things like this. It doesn't excuse any hatred whites might have had for Indians in general. It doesn't excuse any brutality by white people whatsoever. It doesn't excuse it. There is no excuse for that. But we need to understand what happened. And we need to have a true picture of these times in which warfare was for some people constant. And it was a brutal thing, a brutal warfare, and it was a hard life that they lived. Now, we also can mention, as we think of whites that hated Indians, perhaps because of some of these situations we've gone through, and of course Indians hated whites. Some of them had wrongs done against them, but we could mention Daniel Boone. He had 2 sons killed by the Indians. One was just, 17, 16 years old. He was first brutally tortured by an Indian Boone had befriended and helped. But Daniel Boone never hated Indians after that. He never killed an Indian except when necessary in war or self-defense or defense of others. So you have men like that as well. Now, there were also many whites, as you well know, and especially Christians, true Christians, but not only Christians, but true Christians who were greatly concerned for the good of the Indian, spoke against injustices against them, and right from the start, there were missionaries. And on our website, we have some of those early mission stories, such as the apostle to the Indians, as he's called, of course, John Eliot. And the Mayhew family were very early on missionaries to the Indians, trying to reach them with the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. And we have, of course, many other missionary bios on, too, with regard to the Indians. And there were just any number of white men and women, some elected, some in the military, that were very concerned for the good of the Indians. And many devoted time, energy, money, some their whole lives, working for the good of the Indian people. Now, didn't the federal government break treaties made with the Indians sometimes? Yes, they broke plenty of them. But again, we're going to talk about one of those situations where it was rank injustice, but there's many times when it wasn't something that was just planned out. I'll just give you one example. The Sioux were promised the Black Hills, that they could live there forever. It's a reservation, live in perpetuity there. Gold was discovered. White settlers poured in. The army tried to keep them out, couldn't. They were on the brink of a bloodbath. Something had to happen. Well, of course, the Indians suffered the injustice. Someone had to go. Someone couldn't be there. Well, it was the Indians. That was the easiest way out. It seemed to be the only way. So we know Indians also broke treaties sometimes as well. We know that. And then we also know that sometimes when the Indians broke treaties, they were provoked to it because there were crooked Indian agents that didn't, instead of giving them what was promised them on the reservation, they would siphon these things off and give them deficient goods, moldy food or not anything. I just want to mention one more thing. A lot of Americans don't realize that Indians, once defeated, if they wanted to become American citizens, they could go through the steps. It wasn't always overnight, of course. They had to qualify, but they could qualify. And it wasn't a very steep hill to climb, really. They could become American citizens. Instead of living in the reservation, they could receive help to make a start on parcels of land, including those received through the Homestead Act. And so there was all of this that just factors into this whole subject. And I will say one more thing. I will say one more thing on this as far as general remarks. How often has one nation moved into another nation's land, if you want to say one nation, being, of course, in time, the United States of America, engaged in warfare, won, and then took large chunks of land and said, here, you can have that if you want, settle there, we'll pay you for your land. In many cases, these treaties, they paid the Indians that moved off. Many people don't know that. In most cases, they paid them. And we will give you yearly annuities, and we'll give you supplies, or you can become an American citizen, and we will give you a team of oxen, a plow, and help you get started farming. Now, we can't go on this way forever. There's so much we could talk about, but it's a very broad subject, very broad subject. So we've covered only a few things with this very large, multifaceted subject. We've scratched the surface of it, but we have to now move on to a brief history of the Cherokee people leading up to the time that is the time span of our missionary that we're going to be talking about. We need to understand the background of the Cherokee. It's said that at one time, the Cherokee people were the largest people group among Indians, or we should say perhaps the largest tribe or nation of Indians in America. And their territory, really their range or the territory that they ranged over and called their home, of course, but they ranged far and wide. It included what are now the states of Kentucky, Virginia, Tennessee, North and South Carolina, Georgia, and later part of Alabama. And it's not to say other Indian tribes didn't live there, because they did in that area. There was the Choctaw, there was the Chickasaw, there was the Creek, there was the Seminole, there was the Shawnee, all living there. And of course, there was conflicts and fighting amongst them. Now, in the year 1779, it's estimated that the population of the Cherokee tribe or nation at that time was 20,000, and they could field at least 6,000 warriors. It's amazing that white people moved into these areas and started settling. But at any rate, and a lot of them died, of course, as they did move in, the Cherokee, like other tribes, as might be expected, of course, they attacked and waged war against those that were settling there all throughout Cherokee territory. We mentioned Daniel Boone earlier. He grew up in the Yadkin Valley most of his growing up time, from a small boy at least, in North Carolina. And they made raids into that Yadkin Valley. Now, during our War for Independence, the Cherokee sided with the British, and they fought against the Americans, the Patriots. They fought with the British and independently of them. And then during this time, Cherokee warriors were then ranging far and wide, including into Virginia, to attack and, when possible, of course, kill settlers and all that went with that. After the end of the Revolutionary War, they continued their raids until they suffered several devastating defeats in battle against well-led forces of American frontiersmen. And then over time, the Cherokee made a series of treaties with the Continental Congress and then the United States government. They made these treaties. Now, I want to say one thing about these treaties. A lot of times with regard to the Indian tribes, they were in a position where, you know, the handwriting's on the wall. Make the treaty or you come out worse if you don't make the treaty. That's to be to be well understood. We should not try to hide that. But with regard to the Cherokee, they made these treaties, and they ceded portions of their territory to the federal government for various concessions and payments. Now, in 1792, the Cherokee Nation, and this is important as we get to our missionary and the things that happened during his time, the Cherokee Nation and the United States government signed the Treaty of Holston, 1792. Among the terms of the treaty, and you might be surprised if you read the terms of the treaty, it certainly was not a unique treaty, but it's an important one for our story. It set new, because, again, the territory was shrinking of the Cherokee, but it set new fixed boundaries for the Cherokee. It placed them under the protection of the United States government. It included a total ban on white people settling on that territory of the Cherokee or hunting on Cherokee land or doing anything on Cherokee land without permission of the Cherokees, the Cherokee government, if you will. And there was a commitment included of the U.S. government to punish whites who committed any crime against the Cherokee. There was a commitment of the Cherokee to hand over Indians guilty of crimes against whites. There are other terms beneficial to both whites and Indians. Now, that's the Treaty of Holston. And this was a treaty the state of Georgia would eventually trample underfoot. We're going to document that in due time. Now, by the beginning of the 19th century, the 1800s, some of the Cherokee began to turn their attention to farming. They began to turn from warfare to farming. At the start of the 1800s, a few also began to move west of the Mississippi in pursuit of better hunting and less white people. They just voluntarily were moving west, some to Arkansas and some other places. Now, each year, small numbers of other Cherokee followed them. Now, these became known in time because there were then eventually those who moved to Oklahoma Territory when the Indian Territory that the government set up there for relocating Indians was formed. But they became known as the Western Cherokees, and they mostly came from areas other than Georgia, where our story is focused and where the Cherokee did, by and large, not every last one, but they began at a certain point and more to adopt civilized ways, if you will, farming and so forth. Now, we're going to turn our attention now briefly, and it's very briefly, it's quite a glorious history of missionary work among the Cherokees, because this had a profound impact on the civilization of that tribe. With all the benefits of that. And so, as we look at this, it appears Moravian missionaries were the first to attempt mission work among some of the Cherokee who were located at that time near Savannah, Georgia, 1735. Now, that was not without danger. They didn't go way out into Cherokee territory, which would have been very dangerous, but there were some nearby, and they were able to do work there. But it was pretty much a failure. And that was disbanded in 1739. And then the Moravians, never ones to give up or to shy away, of course, from danger, they made another attempt in 1753 in an area of North Carolina. That ended in failure. But they kept up, and then eventually they established some missions among the Cherokee people in various places. The first president of our nation, George Washington, had a very great concern for the welfare of the Indians, including the Cherokee. And he had the wisdom to know that what was good for the Indians would be good for our nation as well in the long run. And so he urged the Indian tribes to be treated with fairness and equity. And he encouraged Christian missionaries to work among the Indians. And there were others in our federal and eventually state governments as well who also shared a concern for the well-being of the Indians. Well, at the same time, of course, there were the Indian haters as well. There was no lack of those as well. But there were many that did share concern for the Indians. Now, in the beginning of the 19th century, here's a name familiar with you because we've done a presentation on him. Presbyterian pastor Gideon Blackburn of Tennessee established the first school for Cherokee children and conducted gospel work among the Cherokee in that area. It wasn't entirely without danger. Things were pretty unsettled where he was still. And this was a very faithful servant of the Lord. Now, Baptists and Methodists all sought to establish mission work among the Cherokee as well in various parts of Cherokee territory over the years leading up to the time of Samuel Worcester, who's the subject of our presentation. Now, many of the Cherokee had determined that it was in their best interest, certainly in Georgia this was true, to adopt civilized ways and occupations, including farming the land. In Georgia, they had a fairly large area that was theirs by treaty. many took English names then. They began to take English names in addition, of course, to their Cherokee names. Now, we're going to be using English names mostly for the simple reason I don't know all their Cherokee names, and the ones I do, I can't pronounce in most cases. And then there were also some that intermarried with whites, and so if that was an Indian woman, she's going to have the white husband's name. So there was some of that as well. So you're going to hear English names. Doesn't always mean that you should picture that Cherokee just being very, very civilized, as we would say, and he may not have been, but many of them were. This is one of the reasons they were taking these names. Now, very relevant to our missionary biography is a Reverend Cyrus Kingsbury, who was greatly encouraged by the missionary work of Reverend Gideon Blackburn in Tennessee. So Reverend Kingsbury asked the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions if they would support a mission among the Cherokee of Tennessee. They agreed to this. Now, the President of the United States at that time, James Madison, heard about this mission effort, and he contacted Reverend Kingsbury to encourage him on. He contacted him through the Secretary of War. He gave them, or him, I should say, this message. In the first instant, the agent for Indian Affairs will be directed to erect a comfortable schoolhouse and another for the teacher and such as may board with him in such part of the nation as will be selected for that purpose. He will also be directed to furnish 2 plows, 6 hoes, and as many axes for the purpose of introducing the art of cultivation among the pupils. If there are any female students, also a female teacher then to teach them to spin, weave, sew, and a loom, and a half dozen spinning wheels, and as many cards. Now, someone will say, isn't that a wrongful involvement of the government getting entangled with the church? This is church work. But the reality was, the government, as you saw, was focused on the education of the Indians and to teach them civilized arts, so to speak. They did not interfere with the preaching or teaching or any such thing, and that's how it was decided this would not be unconstitutional. Now, in October of 1816, Reverend Kingsbury, by a trusted translator, presented his plan of this mission to the General Council of the Chiefs of the Cherokee Nation. Now, the chief who answered for the council after they'd talked the matter over declared, "You have appeared in our full council. We have listened to what you have said and understood it. We are glad to see you. We wish to have the school established and hope it will be a great advantage to the nation." There were wise men among the Cherokee, you see. Now, another chief was appointed to help with the selection of a mission site. A location on Chickamauga Creek on the Tennessee side of the Tennessee-Georgia border was chosen, and the mission was named Brainerd. Now, of course, it was named after David Brainerd, a missionary you're all very familiar with. By June of 1817, the Brainerd mission was in operation with Reverend Kingsbury in charge. In 1817, newly elected President James Monroe, now we talked about James Madison, James Monroe made clear his concern for the Indians of the nation and his view that the government should undertake action which would be for their good, by way of teaching them the benefits of civilization and educating them as well. In March of 1819, Congress passed a bill that allocated $10,000 a year, quote, for the purpose of providing against the further decline and final extinction of the Indian tribes. They were concerned about this, quite the contrary of what we hear, and for introducing among them the habits and arts of civilization. Now, this bill provided for the teaching of what we call the 3 R's sometimes, but reading, writing, and arithmetic, and also agriculture and other mechanical skills such as blacksmithing. On May 17, 1819, President Monroe suddenly, without announcing, appeared at Brainerd. They thought they had heard rumors he might be coming. He's suddenly knocking on the door. He asked all sorts of questions. He was greatly interested in all facets of the work of the mission, including most definitely the evangelistic work. Now, President Monroe was so greatly impressed with the work being done there, and he was encouraged. He expressed support for this work. He liked seeing that Indian children were being brought up in what could be called a Christian family setting. He felt the Cherokee girls needed a better facility, though, and so he directed that a much improved building be built for the benefits of these Cherokee girls that were living there or being taught there, living there as well. And this was going to be paid for by government funds. He had the ability to direct this. You see, it was given him by the government to direct where these funds, $10,000 a year, were allocated with regard to helping the Indians. Now, in the year of 1819, a Cherokee man described as, quote, one of the vilest and meanest of the Cherokees, walked 150 miles on foot to Brainerd. He was being drawn by the Spirit of the Lord. This man, with the English name of John Arch, and in whose heart the Spirit of the Lord was clearly at work, begged to have an opportunity to avail himself of the advantages of the mission. He was so mean, he was so vile previously, that there were those even among the Cherokee that said, don't let him stay. They let him stay. He heard the preaching of the gospel at Brainerd, and upon hearing it, John Arch experienced a genuine conversion to Christ. He was born again. He was baptized, and in time, he acted as an assistant teacher of one of the local mission churches. The missionary of that church, a Reverend Buttrick, knew only English. So John Arch interpreted his preaching for him. The two of them just teamed up then, and they went on mission journeys together among the Cherokee. In one such trip, they covered along the route 2,000 miles. They held 150 preaching meetings. John Arch died at the young age of 28 years old in 1828. He died a man much loved, and his loss was deeply, deeply felt. He died a new creature. He died a trophy of grace. Another Cherokee, actually a mixed-blood girl, brought to faith in Christ at Brainerd was Catherine Brown. I think you've heard of her. I've talked about her a bit. This young woman was said to have been, quote, very haughty and vain, unquote, prior to her conversion to Christ. She became a tremendous trophy of grace herself. She became humble, godly, and much used of the Lord in ministry to the Cherokees. S.J. Mills and John Huss, the English names of these Indians, are two more Cherokee converts of the work at Brainerd that we could mention. Eventually, both of these entered the work of preaching the gospel to the Cherokee. We'll hear a little bit about John Huss again in due time in this message. Now, we're going to return to the Brainerd mission shortly, but first we have to provide a brief sketch of the establishment of the Cherokee government for the Cherokee nation. Now, we could preface this by mentioning that previous to the time we're about to discuss, certain men of the Cherokee had come, of course, under the teaching of missionaries. They had been sent back east for higher education and so forth. At this time, the education of Cherokee children required they be taught English first. There was no written Cherokee language, or there was none at all. But in 1821, an amazing thing happened. An uneducated Cherokee by the name of Sequoia, whose English name was George Guest, developed an excellent, enduring written form of the Cherokee language. And it's an amazing story, but we don't have the time to tell it. But he developed a very good written form. It was very solid. And it continued to be used among the Cherokee, a written form of their language. In 1825, the Cherokee nation chose a site in Georgia to locate their capital. They named this future town that would be built there New Echota. It was named after Echota in Tennessee. In July of 1827, educated Cherokee representatives of the people drew up a constitution which established three branches of government, a legislature with two branches, which were the National Council and the National Committee of the Cherokee. At that time, it met in a log cabin there in Nuwachoda. There was also an executive branch with John Ross, the principal chief of the Cherokee, put in charge of that branch. This Cherokee had been a pupil in the school of Reverend Gideon Blackburn. The third branch of the new government of the Cherokee Nation was a judicial branch with circuit and district courts, as well as a national Supreme Court, which met once a year. And the Cherokee Nation still has the same form of government, and their constitution is modeled or was modeled after our constitution. In addition, sheriffs were appointed to enforce the law and apprehend violators. And there was at this time yet, though, what they called, the Cherokee called blood law, and it had nothing to do with due process or other legal safeguards, but it was based on revenging a wrong, where the one that had done the wrong would be hunted down by the avenger and killed. And we'll hear about that later as well, because not all abandoned that for many years. It would be some time before they would. Now, there were at this time among the Cherokees few true Christians as compared to the whole number of the Cherokees, and many of them, just of the whole number, clung to their heathen religious practices. Now, our focus is the Cherokees in Georgia now, which by the 1830s comprised the great majority of the Cherokee. These Cherokees occupied that portion of Georgia which was guaranteed them by treaty by the federal government. Whites were forbidden from settling there or just coming on there and doing whatever they wanted to. They had to have permission of the Cherokee. By this time, most of the Cherokee in Georgia had turned to farming and to other related occupations, such as blacksmithing. A few continued to provide for themselves by hunting and fishing, though. The average Cherokee farm at this time was 11 acres, but at the same time, there were a number of large plantations that Cherokees had built up, and they were worked by black slaves. The Cherokee held black slaves. There was a Cherokee by the name of Joseph Vans, to give an example of a plantation. He had 800 acres. He had 100 black slaves. So we've set the stage. So now we narrow our focus down to this missionary, Samuel Worcester. I feel like I ought to just mention several main, but by far not only, sources which I use in preparing this message. I like to do that. People say, where did he get these facts? Well, through an awful lot of research and comparing different documents and books and so on and so forth, the facts in them with each other. We're very careful about our facts. So one was the Georgia Historical Society, including a very worthwhile, important report titled The Activities of the Missionaries Among the Cherokees. It was in the Cherokee Historical Society Quarterly, December of 1922. The book Cherokee Messenger by Aletha Bass was another one of my sources, and I just want to caution that I don't believe she was a Christian. She says some things that we wish she hadn't. Now, there were also several in-depth papers written by students of universities for the purpose of meeting requirements for doctor and master's degrees. These are older ones. And then there was the National Archives. And then there was a 27-page paper I used titled Pages from Cherokee Indian History as Identified with Samuel Austin Worcester, D.D. This paper was written in 1884 by a 16-year-old Cherokee girl student of the Worcester Academy in Veneta, Cherokee Nation, Indian Territory, Oklahoma, written in 1884. Now, Oklahoma was still a territory at that time. The girl had the name of Miss Nevada Couch, quite a name. That was the English name that she was given. She's known as Vada. The Worcester Academy in Veneta was established in 1883. She was a student of that academy. And here I'll just say, don't confuse it with the Worcester Academy in Worcester, Massachusetts. that was established in 1834. No connection. See, this is the thing with these sort of subjects. It makes it hard, but you have to mention these things. It might be tedious, but we need to mention them. Now, Vada's paper was written. It's a tremendous paper. It's more like a small book. It was sent out to supporters of the academy as an example of the high quality of education the Cherokee children were receiving there. I want to just read the opening paragraph of the paper written by Miss Nevada Coach. Our institution is called Worcester Academy in honor of Reverend Samuel Austin Worcester, D.D., a true and tried friend of the Cherokee people. And he was. And to this day, the Cherokee people remember Samuel Worcester as their tried and true friend. Now, Samuel was born at Worcester, Massachusetts, on February 1798 to a Congregational church pastor, Leonard Worcester, and his wife Elizabeth, the daughter also of a pastor. Reverend Leonard Worcester was the seventh in a line of Puritan pastors. His son Samuel would become the eighth generation pastor of that family. While Samuel was quite young, his family moved to Peacham, Vermont, where his father pastored a small congregational church. Before entering the ministry, Samuel's father worked as a printer and possibly continued to do at least some occasional labor as a printer after entering the ministry, since his church was very small and the people were far from being well-to-do. At any rate, it's reported that Samuel also learned printing skills, such as how to set type, and that, of course, would be put to good use during his long missionary life among the Cherokee, as would other skills he learned, such as a knowledge of farming and also certain mechanical and carpentry skills and everything from how to butcher a beef to everything having to do with farming. Now, I've not been able to find out a great deal about Samuel's growing up years, but in the fall of 1815, he walked 71 miles to Burlington, Vermont to enroll in the university there. The president of the university was an uncle of Samuel's by the name of Dr. Samuel Austin. In 1816, during what was said to be a revival in the school, Samuel came to faith in Christ and was born again. In 1819, young Samuel graduated with honors. He then spent a year teaching, no doubt to raise funds to attend Andover Theological Seminary, in which he enrolled in 1820, and he graduated from in 1823. He was very proficient by then in Greek and Hebrew and Latin. He was a very skilled linguist. After this, Samuel was employed for a time in the missionary rooms of the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions in Boston. I will call it quite often as we go on, for convenience, the American Board. And he presented himself as a candidate for the mission field. So he spent some time working there first before being sent out on the mission field. He married Miss Ann Orr July 19, 1825. She turned out to be the ideal missionary wife. Miss Nevada Couch wrote of Ann, her home education partook of the Puritan sort, of which she was never ashamed. The same could be said of her new husband. Now, on August 25th, 1825, in the Park Street Congregational Church in Boston, Samuel Worcester was ordained as a minister of Christ, congregational minister. His father preached the ordination sermon. His heart, Samuel's, was set on missionary work among the American Indians. And the American Board then commissioned him to labor among the Cherokee people. In the early morning of August 31st, 1825, Samuel and Ann Worcester left Boston, headed for the territory of the Cherokee. On October 21st, 1825, they arrived at the previously spoken of American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions, Brainerd Mission Station in East Tennessee on the northern border of Georgia. It was an arduous journey, and during various stops, Samuel took every opportunity to preach and to share the gospel with those at those places. The mission station at Brainerd by now had become fairly well established, of course. There were houses for mission families. There was a church. There was a school. There were other buildings. There was an orchard. There was a farm to provide food. It was like a hub, a mission hub, sending out missionaries out to preach in various places and bringing in those to preach to them, I say, among the Cherokee. Samuel Worcester's uncle of the same name, one of the founders, actually, of the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions, which actually traces back to that Haystack prayer meeting that we know of, was buried in the church graveyard there at Brainerd because during a tour of the board's mission stations, he died at Brainerd. Samuel and Anne then labored at Brainerd and in the area until 1827, with Samuel preaching the gospel, teaching the word of God, evangelizing, and also using his mechanical skills for such things as repairing and adding to mission buildings. He was a very hard worker in every way. And he labored there learning the Cherokee alphabet developed by Sequoia, learning the language and learning the alphabet. Now, one of the duties the mission board had charged him with was to work at translating the English Bible into Cherokee. The written Cherokee language Sequoia had developed had by now spread far and wide among the Cherokee. The only Bible they would have at this time, of course, was in English. And they'd have to learn to read English before they could read the Bible. So they needed a Cherokee Bible. And the thing is, they were so proud of that written form of their language, which was also quite easy to learn, that they were not about to give it up. It was very clear to Samuel, and he mentioned this to the board, they want a Bible in their own written language. They're not going to be satisfied till they get one, and they're not going to be as receptive to a Bible written in English. Now, a Cherokee who took the English name of Elias Bodenot, it's quite a name to take, isn't it? He would become Samuel's close friend and valued helper in the translation project. Did not Samuel know the Cherokee written language? He did, but he wanted help from a Cherokee as well to make sure he had an accurate Bible. He knew the Greek, he knew the Hebrew, he knew the English, of course, he knew the Cherokee written language, but he also worked with a Cherokee to produce the best and most accurate translation possible. And so Elias Bodenot would labor with him until his violent death not too many years in the future. During the Worcester's time at Brainerd, Anne taught the Cherokee girls and women various subjects, including homemaking skills, of course. It was during his time at Brainerd that the Cherokee gave Samuel Worcester a Cherokee name. I'm not going to try to pronounce it, but in English, it translates to the messenger. It was at the Brainerd Mission on November 7, 1828, that the Worcester's first child was born. It was a girl they named Ann Eliza, who would grow up in labor among the Cherokee herself until being married to Reverend W.S. Robertson and leaving for mission work among the Creek Nation, because he was a missionary there. In that same year, Samuel and Anne left then the Brainerd Mission Station, and their destination was that capital of the Cherokee Nation, New Echota, in the state of Georgia. Now, the Worcesters arrived in Georgia. Of course, they're in Cherokee territory now. They arrived there in a watershed year for the future of the Cherokee people. That year, two events took place, which taken together made it virtually inevitable that there would be what is now called the Trail of Tears, that tragedy was going to take place, that the Cherokee would be removed from Georgia. Those two events were the discovery of gold on Cherokee land, which only accelerated the lust for it by many of the whites, and the election of Andrew Jackson to the presidency of the United States in 1828. The unprincipled whites of Georgia, not all of the whites, but the unprincipled greedy whites of Georgia, and there were a great many, had already been lusting after the well-kept farms and plantations of the Cherokees. The discovery of gold in Cherokee territory inflamed many of them, men and women, with a lust for that gold. But the Cherokee were not about to give up their land. It was guaranteed them by treaty for perpetuity, I say treaty with the federal government. The presidents of the United States prior to Jackson had been generally and sincerely concerned to be just and equitable toward the Indian tribes. We mentioned George Washington. Certainly, same was true of Adams, Jefferson. We mentioned Madison, Monroe. John Quincy Adams was very much in favor of justice and equity and law for the Indians. But then came President Andrew Jackson. He was elected President of the United States in 1828. He began his term in 1829. He won a second term after that as well. At the end of May 1830, the infamous Indian Removal Act passed Congress, and it came to the desk of Andrew Jackson. He signed it. He was very happy to sign it. He had agitated for it. The act authorized the president to grant Indian tribes east of the Mississippi lands west of the Mississippi. The act principally applied to tribes in the southeastern part of the United States, such as the Choctaws, the Cherokee, the Seminole, the Chickasaw, and the Creek. It was necessary for the tribes, though, to sign new treaties to then render null and void the old treaties. It was necessary they do this, agreeing to the removal, and then the federal government would compensate them for their lands and pay expenses for the removal. Now, of course, once the Indian Removal Act was passed, the Indians were under intense pressure to remove. It wasn't just that the government offers them this deal. They came under such incredible pressure, and in some cases, as you'll hear, there was even persecution to get them to remove. There was coercion, there was deceit. Everything was employed to move them out. Contrary to widespread modern teaching and belief, a great many Americans opposed the Indian Removal Act. There were actually meetings of white Americans called with the aim of blocking the Removal Act in Congress, derailing it so it wouldn't pass. In Boston, a convention was held with the official subject being, quote, the rights of Indians, unquote. Hundreds of citizen petitions poured into Congress, petitions against the removal. Christian missionaries to the Indians, with a few exceptions, were very opposed to the legislation. In Congress assembled, a number of congressmen and senators made impassioned, even fiery speeches supporting the rights of the Indians, opposing the Removal Act. These included Senator Henry Clay and Frontier Congressman Davy Crockett, who gave a very fiery speech against it. Congressman Horace Evarts, in his House speech opposing the Removal Act, declared of the legislation, "The evil, sir, is enormous. The violence is extreme. The breach of public trust deplorable. The inevitable suffering incalculable." The Indian Removal Act, with the support of President Andrew Jackson, did pass the House of Representatives, but by only 4 votes. 107 to 97, 11 representatives abstained. It passed the U.S. Senate by a vote of 28 to 19. One senator abstained. There's a wider margin there. But remember, there were 24 states there. And with regard to the Indian Removal Act, it probably affected at least 5 or 6 minimum. And at that time, it was the state governments, not popular vote, but the state governments by the Constitution that elected the senators. You know that. You know your history, constitutional history. That might explain what happened then. Now, within 1 month of the election of Jackson, the state of Georgia began passing a number of laws which were for the purpose of pushing the Cherokee off their own land, the same land which had been guaranteed them in perpetuity by treaty with the government of the United States of America. One such Georgia law, effective June 1st, 1830, the month after the Indian Removal Act passed, illegally annexed. This was illegal. It was against the treaty that was still in force. Illegally annexed to the state of Georgia all of the land of the Cherokee, which was within the boundaries of the state. It was also by this law, it also made null and void all the laws and customs of the Cherokee Nation. And so it was an illegal act The Cherokee hadn't signed a new treaty agreeing to move west per the Indian Removal Act. And then the new Georgia Act also made illegal for any person of Indian blood to witness against any white man in a Georgia court of law. And then finally, it forbade Cherokees from taking for themselves any of the gold they found on their own land. And then dishonest, unscrupulous Georgia state officials, encouraged by the knowledge they had a friend in President Andrew Jackson, just continually increased their efforts to force the Cherokee of Georgia to sign a treaty for removal west to land set aside as Indian territory in what is now known as the state of Oklahoma. Meanwhile, Samuel Worcester was busy preaching to the Cherokee, sharing the gospel with them, setting up a print shop, of course, and then running it or overseeing it and helping run it, assisting with a new Cherokee newspaper, relatively new, the Phoenix, organizing a school for Cherokee children, and then overseeing it and taking his first steps toward translating the Bible into the Cherokee language. And the Worcester household soon included Cherokee children, and then also sometimes teachers, and then visiting missionaries and visiting government officials even were sometimes hosted there. Samuel Worcester was strongly opposed to efforts to force the Cherokee against their will to give up their land and remove west. He avoided making inflammatory speeches or anything like that. He didn't want to do anything to interfere with the most important duty he had, the preaching of the gospel and the various mission work. But he did make known his beliefs. And consequently, the mission board and the Bureau of Indian Affairs began receiving all sorts of false charges against Samuel Worcester. This became an ongoing affliction for Samuel. He was never intimidated by it, but he had to answer the charges because the mission board would have to ask him, what about this? He'd have to answer it. The Indian Bureau, or the Bureau of Indian Affairs, they would ask about various charges. It took his time. We'll give you one example. He was forced to respond to the Indian Bureau when it was actually Thomas McKinney, the chief of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, who wrote to him with regard to a charge that had been leveled against him for, quote, interfering with the press, and writing the press as in newspapers and so forth, and writing scurrilous articles respecting officers of government and other public men, which he had never done, of course. In a letter he wrote after 2 years of ministry labor among the Cherokee from his mission base in New Echota, Samuel Worcester included this: I believe the greater part of the people acknowledge the Christian religion to be the true religion, although many who make the acknowledgement know very little of that religion, and many others do not feel its power. Through the blessing of God, however, religion, in other words, Christianity, is steadily gaining ground. Another excerpt. It is said abroad and elsewhere that the common people would gladly remove, but are deterred by the chiefs and a few other influential men. It is not so. In June of 1830, Georgia Governor George Gilmore proclaimed that a state land lottery would be held in the near future. In July of 1832, the lottery commissioners made preparations for that lottery, which was open to white people only, but included in the land lottery were the lands belonging to the Cherokee in Georgia, according to treaty with the federal government. Now, this lottery was held on October 22nd, 1832. It was 4 years before the officials, certain representatives of the Jackson administration, by sleight of hand, really, secured a treaty, and we'll talk about that in just a little bit, with the Cherokee for their removal. In the spring of 1835, the state of Georgia put into effect a law which required all white persons residing within the Cherokee Nation to take an oath of allegiance to the state of Georgia, which in turn would have bound such persons to uphold all the laws of Georgia, including these unjust, and there were more of them that were passed, unjust treaty-violating laws that the state of Georgia was putting into effect or attempting to. They were passing them and using them as pressure against the Cherokee. To take the oath would have also made it just a matter of time then before the missionary friends of the Cherokee, such as Samuel Worcester, would have been ordered to leave their mission station, because they had to agree to uphold all the laws of the state of Georgia. And they would have had to leave their mission stations and their work among the Cherokee, because they would have been in violation of the oath they took if they didn't obey the government when they said leave, because they did say leave. Now, those whites living among the Cherokee were required also to get a license from the state of Georgia if they wished to remain. This, we say whites, this was aimed at the missionaries. In the missionaries' case, this meant then a license from the state to preach the gospel and minister to the Indians. Failure to take the oath or failure to get a license was punishable by not less than 4 years of hard labor in the state penitentiary. It's to be noted that President Andrew Jackson supported the state of Georgia in all these unlawful treaty-defying attempts to force the Cherokee off their own lands, their own farms, their own villages, and their own plantations. Samuel and several other missionaries refused to take the oath or to get a license, whereupon Georgia Governor Gilmore ordered them to immediately leave the territory of the Cherokee Nation or be arrested and sent to prison. Governor Gilmore also accused missionary pastor Worcester of actively opposing the state of Georgia's laws. Samuel Worcester replied to the governor with a long letter. I want to read a few excerpts. It really reveals the mettle of the man. If the opposition is that I have had the misfortune to differ in judgment from or with the executive of the United States, that's the president, in regard to the tendency of those measures recently enacted for the removal of this and other tribes, and that I have freely expressed my opinion, I cheerfully acknowledge the fact and can only add that the expression of opinion has been unattended with guilt. Jumping forward. Shall I then abandon the work which I have engaged? Your Excellency is already acquainted in general with the nature of my object and my employment, which consists in preaching the gospel and making known the word of God among the Cherokee people. As to the means used for this end, aside from the regular preaching of the word, I have had the honor to commence the work of publishing portions of the Holy Scripture and other religious books in the language of the people. My own view of duty is that I ought to remain and quietly pursue my labors for the spiritual welfare of the Cherokee people until I am forcibly removed. I will stop there. And I will pick up this afternoon.